Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I'm a writer and film critic, and today I am delighted to be talking to Graham Skipper, who is the author of a new book, Godzilla, The Official Guide to the King of the Monsters. This is a book which has been commissioned by Toho, the company behind Godzilla. Originally founded in 1932, it has produced a whole series of movies, including the Godzilla movies. Graham is a writer, an actor, a director, a producer. He's made his own horror movies, such as Sequence Break. He's written a book of essays for Fangoria and My Favorite Horror Book. He has also appeared in Reanimator the Musical as Herbert West himself for Stuart Gordon, the late lamented Stuart Gordon. And he's written an amazing book. I mean, there's no one more qualified than Graham to write upon this subject. And this is a beautiful book. It's got loads of great photographs in it, and it gives you a film-by-film guide to a genre which is really loved by many. And if you haven't dipped into it, if you haven't ever watched a Godzilla movie, then this book's kind of a really good way of starting, because it will definitely give you a way in to what is a fascinating and entertaining genre. If you enjoy the episode, please remember to like and subscribe and do all those things I ask you to do. Should I stop asking you to do it? Is it a bit boring for me to, you know? I was thinking the other day when I was listening back to an episode that maybe I repeat myself too much. Maybe I've become a little bit too formulaic in saying certain things. So let me know if you think I should shake it up a little bit and be a little bit looser. It's just a way of trying not to say too much, I guess. If you have a sort of script in your head, you can just, you know, ride that without having to worry too much about actually having to think about what you're saying. But that doesn't necessarily make for the most compelling listening experience. So yeah, let me know about that. That'd be an interesting, any feedback you have would be interesting. We're heading towards 100th episode now, so always looking towards shaking things up and making it more enjoyable. Oh, on another little bit of personal news before we get to our conversation with Graham, I'm setting up and developing a new podcast which is going to be about Italian cinema and will hopefully offer you a kind of guided tour of the worlds of Italian cinema, and I'm going to look at everything from giallo to spaghetti western to neorealism to silent movies, white telephone films, the whole gamma, the whole range of Italian cinema. So that should be coming out in the next few weeks. It's in the process of development at the moment, approaching guests, recording episodes and everything. So that's something I hope that you will be interested in too. Before any of that, enjoy the conversation.
I was in Reanimated the Musical. Yeah, Stuart Gordon directed it. He became a very close friend, and I played Herbert West.
Wow.
Did it for about 4 years, and it's sort of what got me. It is what got me into the horror business. It's kind of where I met everybody. It's where I met Joe Bigas. Joe was the stage manager on that show, and so that's where we met.
Brilliant. And congratulations on the book. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I have to admit, and yeah, again, in a way, this is sort of like a perfect thing for a perfect reader for the book. My knowledge of Godzilla is restricted to the very first movie and the sort of later American remakes and the cartoon when we were kids with Godzuki and all that kind of stuff. But your book made me really go, I've got to watch some of these other, films.
Good. Well, that's the goal.
What was your first experience of Godzilla?
When I was probably 5 or 6 years old. My grandparents, had a house out in the country, and we would go there every other weekend or so. And they had, if this was ever as popular over in Europe, it might have been these huge satellite dishes in the backyard. Mm-hmm. Back in like the early days of like satellite TV. So they had this huge satellite dish that would pick up all the channels that it could. So like it picked up HBO, even though they didn't pay for it. It picked up, all the other sort of pay channels that we didn't have. And on HBO, I remember distinctly, they had one TV, and it was a little bitty TV in their bedroom. And it was up on the wall. And I would just sit in there and watch whatever was on TV. And I saw coming up next on HBO was King Kong versus Godzilla. And I remember thinking, and this is one of my earliest memories, I remember thinking, well, I know who King Kong is, and I know who Godzilla is, and I like monsters. And so I'm probably going to like this, you know? And so I watched it, and I just loved it. And then my whole thing, back then HBO played Godzilla movies all the time. So that was whenever I go visit them, I just sit back there and just wait for Godzilla movies to come on.
They'd have them like on in rotations.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just, you kind of knew the time of day on. It was a blast. I loved it from the very beginning, and I loved all the toys. And like I said, I've always been a monster kid. And so it was really just, I don't know, it was just kind of like a perfect mixture of things for me, because I was also a scaredy cat, and they weren't that scary. I liked monsters, but I was afraid also. So like Frankenstein and the Wolfman and stuff, like that stuff scared me a little too much. But Godzilla, it was fun, but it was still a monster. So I think that's kind of why I fell in love with it.
Are you still scared? Because I'm a big horror fan, but I'm absolutely terrified of horror films, and it's kind of that's my thrill, but I'm not jaded.
I wouldn't say I'm jaded. I enjoy them. There's certainly some films that scare me. Hereditary is the one that pops into my head most recently that really genuinely scared me. I get very scared by horror video games. Horror movies don't tend to scare me as much anymore, but horror video games, they really get me. I still get scared. That's why I love them, is because either they're going to be like a comfort blanket, or they're going to be fun, or they're going to be something that I know I'm going to enjoy, or it might be something that actually gives me a thrill, which, you're always chasing that dragon.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when you're watching these Godzilla movies, you're watching presumably the sort of American versions it was really interesting in your book, as you sort of talk about the Japanese ones first, and then in America, they put in a couple of, Raymond Burr turns up or something, and you throw in a few newscasters, and then and cut out subplots and stuff. So which version are you watching on HBO?
So back then it was the American version. So the Japanese version of the original Godzilla wasn't available in the US until something like 2004.
Wow.
It was way, way, way later that anybody in America was able to see that. Now, I'm sure, in Europe or something, if I had been an astute film kid, you know, and had gone to Germany or something, I could have found the original one. But yeah, but it none of those were available really until the 2000s. And a lot of them weren't available easily until like the Criterion set that came out. Like, I hadn't seen the original Japanese version of King Kong versus Godzilla until the Criterion set came out when I watched it. And I vastly prefer the original. I mean, I have a great affinity for the American version, but it's just so interesting to me to watch the original versions of these films and see what were changed, you know, what things were changed and try to understand why, you know, like with the original Gojira. I mean, the idea of adding Raymond Burr is essentially to, one, give an American voice, and two, to sort of provide like context and narrative description for what they thought was going to be a stupid American audience. You know, well, they're not going to know what's going on, so we got to tell them, you know. And then there's also this added layer of like American kind of machoism of like, we're going to kill this monster. You know, in the Japanese version, it's a lot more, you know, dour and tragic, but it's not so much about like how amazing the military is. It's about how unstoppable this force is. Mm. And they sort of recontextualize that a little bit for the Americans. For King Kong versus Godzilla, I actually find, and I want to say too, that I don't mind the Raymond Burr version. It's they still keep a lot of the soul of it. And I actually think the craft of being able to realistically insert Raymond Burr into these scenes and you know, and they do that a lot now. Like it was funny, I was watching the new Fast and Furious 10 trailer and where they essentially insert Jason Momoa into scenes from Part 5 that he was never actually in. I was like, oh, they're doing a Raymond Burr. Like, that's what they did with Raymond Burr, Godzilla. But with King Kong versus Godzilla, the original Japanese is very funny. It's very cartoony. It's big. It's extremely satirical. They really lean into kind of the slapsticky nature of the humor. And in the American version, they take it takes itself a bit more seriously, which I think is kind of to its detriment. Because the American version to me is a little hokey, and it's a little like, you know, there's no way to really make these two monsters the way that they're designed in this movie look cool. I mean, to a 5-year-old, they're cool, but watching it now, it's like they're not cool. It's a little goofy, you know. It takes itself too seriously. And at least in the original Japanese, you can see the original vision was one really sending up the satirical or really satirizing, you know, the commercial entertainment business in a way that leaned very heavily into the comedy. And I just think it works better.
It's interesting when you say that as well, that at the very beginning, you're talking as well about the fact that this is coming out of a Japan, post-war Japan, which has been traumatized by the nuclear attacks on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And yet, at the same time, they're looking at this massive destruction happening with Godzilla, and they're doing it in a satirical way, in a way which isn't necessarily taking itself too seriously, because it seems to have at its core something which is incredibly tragic, and yet it's being dealt with and played with in a way which is contains humor.
Yeah, well, I mean, Godzilla, you know, after the original film, which was just a gigantic massive success, you know, locally in Japan and then globally, you know, they were obviously exploring these themes of the bomb and of their relationship with the bomb, and this kind of very Japanese sensibility of like we are partially to blame for what happened, and how do we as a nation and as a cultural identity, like how do we deal with that, and how do we accept responsibility while also mourning the deaths of all of these civilians, and so that's what Gojira is all about. But then you get into, you know, the first sequel, Godzilla Raids Again, and then certainly then with King Kong versus Godzilla, and I think what they did, which again is a very unique Japanese concept, where they then accept this thing, this creation, and then turn it into a cultural identity. They turn that into an icon that represents them, And so then Godzilla starts to shift away from being a menace to being a friend, you know, and he doesn't really fully become like a friend until Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster. You know, he's generally always kind of a menace up until then, but he's, but it becomes, they become funnier, they become more kid friendly. They start to emphasize other messages of you know, ecological sustainability and like whatever it is in each film. But yeah, I think that it's because the Japanese then said, all right, we've created this monster that, and that now becomes our totem, our icon that we own, and it can become a good thing. And so what if we're able to turn this thing that was once bad into a protector and a friend of Japan? And that's really what they did. You know, in each of the eras of the films, they sort of reset and they kind of re-explore that in new context every time. But I just find it really, you know, amazing. And you touched on it with what you said of how they, you know, the first film is such a stark, dire, horrific examination of the nuclear bomb and of the aftermath of that. And then able to then that character evolves into something that is not just a friend of humanity, you know, but is practically a Saturday morning cartoon, is a friend of kids, you know, kids hug onto their Godzilla dolls and love their Godzilla toys. I mean, they even, you know, they play with that and you know, like Godzilla versus Megalon, like the, you know, the kid has Godzilla toys, you know, even in the universe, the kids love Godzilla. And so I think it's just, it's about, you know, I mean, it this is a way oversimplification, but it's like turning lemonade, you know, out of lemons, right? You take something bad and you turn it into something good. And I think that's what Godzilla represented for a lot of people.
I mean, I guess it's sort of something that happens quite generally with horror as well, isn't it? You know, the Freddy of the first Nightmare on Elm Street film is a, like, murderous pedophile, and you're kind of, you know, and by the second, third one, he's a kind of more cartoonish sort of anti-hero who you're kind of watching the films for the purpose of seeing how's he going to kill the next person, you know? So you kind of have to, you can't just keep hating on someone if that's the reason you're going to the cinema to see them. You've got to.
Sure. Yeah. You need to root for them, you know? And I think like examples like Freddy and Jason, obviously they're a little bit different because they're still the antagonists, but even then you look at, like, you know, in like Friday the 13th part 6, you know, which is essentially an out and out like comedy, you know, it's a send up of Universal movies. Now, is Jason like protecting the people? No. Like, I think that's where it differs with Godzilla, where, you know, Godzilla, you know, the there is still a bad, you know, it'd be sort of the same as if, like, I don't know, if in Freddy versus Jason, if Freddy showed up and all of a sudden Jason was protecting the kids. But yes, absolutely. I mean, I think that you, over the course of all of these different these franchises, and especially with Godzilla, they definitely evolve in such a way to where you are you're really rooting for him, and you are excited when he shows up, not because he's going to destroy everybody, but because he's going to help you. I mean, that's like kind of the whole premise of Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla, is that Godzilla shows up and he's bad and holy shit. You know, and he beats up Anguirus, one of his best monster friends. And even Anguirus is like, holy shit, you know, what's going on? Well, it's revealed that it's not really Godzilla, that's Mechagodzilla. So even baked into the substance of these later movies, Godzilla being bad becomes such a foreign concept that it's like horrific when he shows up and he's doing bad things. It just becomes a totally different film, and the people are just horrified going, I can't believe Godzilla's bad, you know. And you think back to the original film, it's like, wow, you know,
how far we have come.
Yes. Yeah.
So when you start getting these different monsters coming in, and you'll have to help me with the pronunciation, because the Japanese word for them is Kajuru, is that right?
Kaiju.
Okay, so when you get these kaiju coming in, first of all, I guess, I mean, it's a bit of a basic question, but what's your favorite of the kaiju?
Oh, gosh. I mean, probably Mothra. I mean, right. You know, I love Mothra. you know, Mothra is, you know, the Earth Mother. Mothra is always a good character. Even from the beginning. Probably Mothra. I mean, I love all of them. I love Ghidorah. Ghidorah is just always scary. And I love a good, Ghidorah really is like the sort of epitome of what of a villain for Godzilla. It's the true match. Yeah, I mean, I love all of them. You know, it's interesting because a lot of these kaiju that come in, they already had their own franchises. So right, like
Mothra in the wake of
Mothra had her own movie. Rodan had her own series. The Rodan series is actually very good, very scary. Ghidorah, I don't believe, did. But yeah, like, you know, it was truly kind of the first, you know, when we think of like the Marvel Cinematic Universe and all these characters sort of coming into other movies, you know, this was the progenitor of all of them. And it was all because Toho, one, saw the value of creating new series after movies, and then with all the ones that they owned, they were able to you know, throw these popular characters together, which is why King Kong versus Godzilla came about, because they had the rights to King Kong, you know. Mm-hmm. and that, I mean, that like in Godzilla Raids Again, he had fought Anguirus, who was just a creation that they made up for that movie, but became a very popular character. King Kong versus Godzilla, that was the first time that two really iconic characters like that from two different, you know, film franchises were, you know, put together in a movie. And it was, I mean, it was like the Avengers of that. It was the hugest movie in the world. It was gigantic, you know, and that really laid the scene for moving forward of them realizing how much people loved that. And I mean, down to, you know, some of the monsters were created by contests. You know, they would have contests, like a school children contest, to create a new monster. That's where Jet Jaguar came about, you know. So they had fun with it. They've learned how to have fun with it, and it became a hallmark of why that series has now lasted for, you know, going on 70 years.
I was about to say that as my next question, really, was in terms of how it relates to the sort of the idea of a cinematic universe with the Avengers and Marvel and what have you. But you've already asked and answered, as the lawyers would say. So I mean, as you go, the way you divide you organize the book is you're giving a very good chronology, and you're dividing it into phases in terms of the sort of Japanese imperial sort of history as it goes. But it's really interesting as you see creators moving in and moving out, and how the tone changes. And it's I found it interesting how it gets more serious as you get into the 80s and 90s. Why do you think that was?
Good question. I think that, well, one, you know, a hallmark that you see of every time that an era resets, you know, when they take a break and then come back, they all tend to want to come back with, okay, Godzilla's scary again. Right. You know, let's go back to that. And we see that in, like, when you think the like kind of any remake of any of these big horror franchises or any reboots, they tend to, you know, say, okay, we're going to ignore everything except for the original one. You know, it's like what they did with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre recently.
Right.
You know, with the Friday the 13th remake, which I actually think is quite good. You know, that's what they do. They just ignore everything else and then go back to the original one. Alien did that. And I think that's kind of necessary, because, you know, as you continue to try to, you just get so muddy with trying to rehash all the stuff, and there's nowhere for it to go. If they just continued what was happening in the Showa era, you know, there would be nowhere for the franchise to go except getting sillier and sillier. I think in the 80s also, horror films, they went one of two ways. They were all very violent, which you see in these, that's the Heisei era, is the 80s and the 80s and 90s. Those movies are very violent. You know, we see Godzilla bleed. You know, we see a lot, just a lot more gore and violence in those movies. But also, you know, I think that in general, the threats that they were talking about were just kind of more immediately present. Right. Like, the threat of nuclear war was right there. You know, the Cold War, it was thick with that fear. You know, with the Showa era, for the most part, you know, it was a look back at what had happened, but then there's like an optimistic moving forward. The Heisei era, which I like quite a bit, that's my personal favorite era, they you know, they I think do a good job of trying to kind of react to the intensity of what was going on globally at the time. The millennium era, then, you know, that whole era for me is just kind of characterized by bigger, fancier, you know, more technology. They have two mixed degrees, you know, more computer generated technology. It's the millennium era is kind of like bigger is better. And once again, they start off very dark and serious. And even though each movie is of a more serious nature, I mean, by the time you get to Godzilla Final Wars, which is one of my favorites in the whole franchise, it's just absolutely mad. You know, it's just totally insane. But I mean, you have something like, you know, like Godzilla, Mothra, and King Ghidorah, giant monsters all out of attack, which is arguably like the scariest one. Since, you know, it makes Godzilla scary again. It's Godzilla possessed by the spirits of the dead that died in the Pacific Theater during World War II. And so, you know, you have Godzilla with these white eyes and this big scary snarl, and it becomes it's just a generally more adult, more frightening depiction. So I don't know if that's, you know, just due to the franchise getting older, and so they wanted to grow older with it. I think a lot of it has to do with the creative teams changing, you know, where, you know, kind of like we see today, it's like when we watch a superhero movie from the 80s, they tend to be funnier, lighter, all that stuff. And then now, because the kids that were watching those have grown up, now we have some of these more serious and intense superhero movies. So I think that was also partially what was happening was, you know, the kids that grew up in Star Wars, another example, right? The new movies are so serious. And so I think that's also kind of like what happened was these creative teams, just as they were getting older and as they took control of this franchise that they loved, they wanted to make it into the thing that they imagined when they were playing with their toys and saying, let's make the really cool Godzilla now. And it all works. That's what I love about the franchise is they all have their different flavors. And when people ask me, oh, what movie should I start with? You know, I often don't say start with the original. The original is pretty intense. It's kind of like, you know, saying start with Citizen Kane if you want to watch it, you know, like a movie, you know. It's like with my niece is she just turned 10 and she's into kind of this stuff. Like she loves, you know, Wednesday on Netflix and like A Nightmare Before Christmas. And so I said, let's watch a Godzilla movie. I certainly wasn't going to make her watch the original one, but I did show her Godzilla versus Mothra from the 90s. And she loved it, you know, so it's like you really can. There's so many different flavors here and you can really pick and choose what to watch based on what people's certain proclivities are. And I think that's one of the strengths of the franchise.
One of those proclivities or one of those flavors, actually, would be a better way of putting it, is that of the like a science fiction genre, because monster movies in themselves, and you can correct please correct me if I'm wrong, because you're the expert here, feel to me like they're like a separate quite a defined subgenre of science fiction. And the science fiction elements that come in later, like aliens, like other planets and things like that, it's a shift, you know. It reveals how the original Godzilla, you know, you have this one science fiction element, which is this big, big monster, but it's also kind of almost like a fantasy element or, an adventure element. I mean, would you define King Kong as science fiction? I mean,
I wouldn't. I would define King Kong as, you know, an adventure movie. It's in the same vein as like Indiana Jones or something like that for me. And I mean, I think there are certainly science fiction elements in the original Gojira. It's, you know, I mean, you have the oxygen destroyer, you have kind of the mad scientist who is creating this thing, you know, and yes, you have you have Godzilla, but even then, I don't, you know, I think it's just kind of its own thing. It's like a monster movie. But yeah, I mean, by the time we get to Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster, and definitely by Invasion of Astro Monster. I mean, they lean heavily into science fiction. But what I kind of love about at least with the Godzilla franchise is, for the most part, the science fiction elements, they don't focus on them in a way of like trying to really, you know, make them realistic or like explain things, you know, like you might see in like a Star Trek movie, right? Where they're kind of talking about, you know, how the deflector dish is going to do XYZ. It's more like, and there's a black hole with aliens around it, and we have a rocket and we're on the moon, you know? And it's just like, I think is a way for them to expand that universe out and just have more reasons for more monsters of like different crazy styles to come in and play in their sandbox. But I love it. I mean, I love how wild they get and how kind of, you know, just totally goofy. How just totally goofy a lot of that stuff gets. I mean, the costumes alone and Invasion of Astro Monster are like so bonkers. I still want to someday do a Halloween costume from that.
Plenty of ideas. I mean, do you think that has something to do as well with, I mean, you mentioned earlier about the sort of Japanese, you know, concerns or lens or the certain way, certain cultural norms that Japan has, which makes these films interesting from our perspective as well. Do you think that's also sort of like how story is handled? You know, that it's not, they're not going to the same screenwriting classes that people in the West or in America or Hollywood are. And so it's, they don't play by the same rules necessarily. And they're sort of like, okay, here's a bunch of aliens, and we're not going to, as you say, Star Trek it or fit it into some other template.
That's interesting, and that's a good point. I mean, I think that one, I think you're definitely correct, is that they, especially back then, I mean, they took a lot of inspiration from Western movies. You know, they took, I mean, the kind of the whole inspiration for the original Gojira was like Roger Corman films. You know, they saw these big monster movies with like stop motion animation. It was Beast from 20,000 Fathoms was the movie that especially inspired them to make Godzilla in the first place. So they took a lot of inspiration from that, but then I think just culturally in Japan, I am being very broad here, and I am by no means an expert on Japanese culture, and there's a whole lot more layers and a whole lot more complexity to it, obviously, than what, you know, I might say. But I think culturally, like even just, you know, having visited Japan, when you turn on the TV, the stuff you're watching is, to our eyes, just completely chaotic and bonkers, you know, and you've got picture in picture of people's faces watching this thing, and then like explosions, and then it'll suddenly change a scene completely and not have anything to do with what happened before. So I think just like from an entertainment standpoint, they just have a greater the word is patience for that sort of thing. You know, I think they more readily and willingly accept things that might not be totally logical, you know, whereas an American audience might kind of go, you know, cross their arms and be like, well, that doesn't make sense. A planet can't revolve around a black hole. Whereas Japanese audiences are like, sure, whatever, show me the monsters, you right. know, and just like fall into it more easily. So I think that's definitely a thing that would be an interesting kind of study to do about you know, Japanese sensibilities regarding entertainment from that perspective. Yeah, that would be interesting.
I think, yeah, it's funny because we're it's kind of happening at the moment with Netflix and
with LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You know, a lot more availability of Japanese and, of course, Korean and just mm-hmm. international culture, or even something like I'm a huge fan of Beat Takeshi Kitano's work, and then you mm-hmm. realize made these brilliant gangster Yakuza movies, such as Violent Cop was one, and Fireworks was another, and yet in Japan he's famous as a comedian and for being the game show guy who did Takeshi's Castle, and it's just like,
yeah,
you know, it's like, how do those two things fit together, you know, how does that, you know, it's just unbelievable. But at the same time, I mean, what would be the equivalent? It would be like having like Montel Williams make Martin Scorsese movies or something.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think we see that, though, right? It's like we see the transition of Jim Carrey from being a silly, you know, rubber-faced comedian to doing like The Truman Show, or doing, you know, these what was the movie about like the movie theater that was really serious, or, you know, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Bill Murray also, you know, so we see that happening, or even like, in the horror world, like Wolf Creek. Oh, I'm blanking on his name right now, but the gentleman that plays the bad guy in that, he's famous for being a big comedian in Australia. He's like a very famous funny man in Australia, and all we know him from is Wolf Creek, where he's this completely sinister and evil, scary character. So I think that happens kind of in every culture, but maybe. And maybe the Japanese are a little bit more willing to, and again, this is a big overgeneralization, but maybe the Japanese are a little bit more willing to accept that more quickly than American audiences are, where American audiences are always very, or tend to be, you know, they're pretty judgy, you know, they go into something and they're like, Robin Williams in a serious role. Well, we'll see about that, you know, and then we give them all the awards. But I don't know. That's interesting. It's, you know, Japan is such an amazing place, and there. Have you ever been?
No,
to Japan?
No, I haven't. No, it's definitely on my bucket list, though.
It's an incredible place. I had the opportunity to go a number of years ago, and it just really is amazing to see, to step into a world that is 100% different from what you've ever known. Mm. You know, it's you know, mostly like if I go to Europe, right? I've been to Berlin a number of times, right? And even though I don't speak German, I walk around, I know what a hot dog stand is, you know, I can walk into a convenience store and I know what soda to get. And I can fudge my way through the, you know, and people speak English, you know, if I need help, you know, and stuff like that. In Japan, it's just, you have none of that. I mean, you'll look at a vending machine and not know if something's a coffee or a beer or some weird milk soda that you've never heard of before, you know, and nobody speaks English, and you're just kind of like figuring it out. And it's so exhilarating and exciting. And I think, you know, that sense about Japanese culture, where they are true, like true unique to themselves, just shapes their entertainment and their cinema in a way that is just endlessly fascinating to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that. I think that's a really interesting point, because we tend to talk about globalization, or we used to. We don't seem to talk about it anymore, but we used to talk about globalization as being, you know, everywhere is becoming the same. But it's such an oversimplification and generalization, because you go to different places, it's like, nope, this isn't the same. This is totally different. And so when you come to like the American later remakes, when you come to people like Emmerich, I guess being the first major one. I remember the trailer for Emmerich's Godzilla, the very, very first like teaser trailer, and it was like a massive foot crashing down on a T-Rex skeleton in the museum. Mm-hmm. And it was really sort of, oh, you saw Jurassic Park? You know, this is the king of monsters. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I mean, it that came out in 98, so I would have been 15 when that came out, right? Yeah, 15. I loved it when it came out. I flipped out over that movie. I had the soundtrack. I I know I saw it multiple times at the theaters. As a, you know, as an adult looking back on it and as a Godzilla fan, is it a good Godzilla movie? No. Is it a fun, like if Roland Emmerich had just made his own giant monster movie and not called it Godzilla, I think that people would be a lot kinder to that movie. I mean, it's silly, it's dumb, you know, it's, there's not much substance to it. And dumb is just sort of the operative word of that movie. but it's, to me, it's certainly entertaining. You know, the thing about that movie was the American studios had for a long time been really wanting to make a Godzilla movie. And it, you know, there have been a few like stops and starts, you know, throughout the years, but finally when Emmerich was given the greenlit to make it, I mean, he admits he was not a fan of the original franchise. He didn't get it. He didn't like the more serious ones, you know, and he just sort of threw everything out the window except for the title Godzilla and the idea that it was a big lizard. And he just, and he admits in interviews, he was like, yeah, we just threw everything out and just made our own thing, which is understandably upsetting to Godzilla fans, you know, but I think that also is a very kind of unique American sensibility of like, I don't care what they did, I'm just gonna do my own thing, it's gonna be bigger and splashier and we're gonna put Matthew Broderick in it and whatever. I do think that the legendary ones that are now out, I actually like those quite a bit. I think that they are doing a good job. I really love Mike Doherty's Godzilla King of the Monsters. I don't understand why that one seems to get the most hate out of this new batch of films, because I really like it quite a lot. I think that it is kind of the best example of what we're able to do with modern technology of showing these monsters kind of the way we all imagined them as kids. You know, when you watch Godzilla versus Mothra, what you're seeing, you know, is not like a photorealistic, you know, whatever, but what you're imagining when you're, you know, I'm holding up like Godzilla, I have Godzilla toys everywhere, but it's like when you play with these toys, what you're imagining in your head is something so much more incredible and grand and everything. And I think that he really managed to capture that with that movie, you know. And then same with like Godzilla versus Kong, you know, they leaned into, we are making a big monster brawl. And I think they did a great job at it. I love the reinvention of Mechagodzilla. You know, what a great villain to bring back, and what a great, you know, kind of way to reimagine it for a modern audience and to make it actually like scary. Yeah, I mean, I like what they're doing, and you know, there are some purists that really don't like them, and that's fine. You know, but I think that for me, as long as it's like different, then I'm happy. It's like I'm glad, like with Shin Godzilla, you know, Shin Godzilla. It comes out and it is so completely 180 from like what they were doing at the end of the Millennium Era, which I also love. But I'm glad that they came back and they said, no, we're gonna do this a completely different way and still use the icon and the iconography of Godzilla to tell a story that is about culture and about the planet. But we're gonna do it differently than you've seen it before. That's what I really appreciate when a filmmaker does that.
I muted myself and forgot to unmute myself. if only that would happen more often, shout the whole audience. What you were saying about Godzilla versus Kong, and I think this also goes for John Wick to some degree, is those films are, to me actually, are proof that some film directors and some creatives in Hollywood have soaked up the Japanese model for doing things, or in the case of John Wick, the Hong Kong model for doing things, of action cinema is just purely about the fights. So we're going to cut out the shit and just have a 90-minute fight. And that's basically John Wick, although apparently the new one's like 3.5 hours long or something. And the same thing with Kong. You know, if you're sitting there waiting for the characters to somehow have some impact in the story, then you're going to be disappointed. You know, you have to watch it thinking, no, I just want to see these two monsters fight for as long as possible.
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, and again, this is a very sort of American take on the Godzilla franchise, you know, Americans tend to look at the original Godzilla films and go, well, it's just a reason to get two monsters to fight, and the human stories like don't really matter. Which couldn't be further from the truth in the Japanese films. Japanese films have quite a lot of human story, and they're often really engaging and really interesting. And a lot of that was from the guidance of Ishiro Honda, as he was, you know, really helping guide the franchise in the early years, that these were human stories where the monsters were elements impacting them. The Americans, you know, have since, you know, sort of taken that and said, well, no, human stories don't matter, and make it and make it all about the fighting. I actually think that Gareth Edwards and Murray, I have heard people complain that there's too much human business in those movies and not enough fighting, and that's why they don't like them. I feel the opposite way, where I like the human stuff, and I like that it is what frames the fighting and why we care about the fighting. With Godzilla versus Kong, though, I am a huge fan of what they did and what you reference of saying, yep, we are going to give you want to see them fight? They're going to fight. Mm. You know, this is, we are not going to be making any like really big statements about anything. We're going to show you two giant monsters and then eventually three giant monsters fighting, and it's going to be fucking badass. And that's what it was, you know, and it was great. I saw it three times in the theater. It was like, and even if I wasn't a Godzilla fan, I would have seen it that way anyway, because it's just fun. And that's, again, a great thing about this franchise is that, look, if you want like intense and intelligent social commentary, it's got you. If you want just a fun afternoon out at the movies, seeing some silly nonsense, it's got you. You know, it's a flavor for everyone.
Back to the flavor, this ice cream Godzilla.
Yes, which I've Lord knows they have, I'm sure, done many Godzilla flavors of ice cream.
Absolutely. What about the other sort of legacy of Godzilla outside of the actual Godzilla movies, in terms of, I mean, I was thinking of things like Guillermo del Toro doing Pacific Rim, which just feels like a Godzilla movie, but it's the other monsters that Godzilla will fight at some further stage, you know? What do you think of that sort of how it spilled out in that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it set the stage for this idea, at least in the West, because it was more, I think it was more of like a, in Japan, you know, there are some stories of like, you know, these giant monsters, and they have more of a kind of a non, I don't know what you might call it, like a more fantastical kind of mythological history than maybe we do. But yeah, I think that it totally opened up the West's eyes to this idea of like, oh, giant monsters are fun. You know, Godzilla has such an enduring history that, sure, like filmmakers like Del Toro, you know, saying, I want to do Pacific Rim. I mean, this is, you know, it's a no-brainer. I mean, or you look at like Stuart Gordon with Robot Jocks, right? Mm. Like same sort of thing, you know, those are mechas, but that again is a Japanese manga creation. So we have adopted in the same way as the Japanese kind of adopted the Western back in the 50s when like Kurosawa was making Seven Samurai and stuff like that, have in turn then adopted so many of these Japanese tropes and Japanese ideas because they're awesome. They're fun. Who doesn't like a giant mecha? You know, I mean, Power Rangers, you know, were such a huge cultural thing in the 90s for all of us. Ultraman, you know, Voltron, you know, and then that, like I recently, I don't know if this was big over in Europe. Did you all have the show Silverhawks?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely had a bunch of these anime shows that have come through, and I'm in Italy at the moment, and they're huge fans of things like Captain Harlock and Cat's Eyes, and yeah. All of that stuff that's basically their sort of 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock viewing when terrestrial television used to be a thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was the same. Like I obviously Saturday cartoons. You know, but like when I think of Silverhawks, which was this kind of a it was essentially like Thundercats, which has sort of become a lot more famous in the intervening years, but it was the same kind of basic thing. But they had this, it was all about transforming the vehicles to make a bigger vehicle and joining together, you know, which is very kind of Voltron-y, Power Ranger-y idea. And all that stuff is influenced by the Japanese. And again, it's like, you know, when you ask why do I think that happened? I just think it's because it's cool. You know, it's fun. It's good entertainment. And it leans into this like non-realistic, you know, we don't have to explain it. We don't have to explain how the Megazord, you know, worked in Power Rangers. We just have to accept that it did because it was cool. And I kind of went off on a tangent there, but yeah, I think that I love that we continue in the West to absorb this Japanese entertainment. I love that anime is bigger than it seems it ever was. You know, I teach sometimes at a middle school here in Texas, and the kids are all about the different anime shows. Right. You know, they know so much more than, you know, that, or like Pokemon is back. And it just goes to show like these are really enduring symbols. And every single one of those kids, even if they haven't seen a movie, they know who Godzilla is. Mm. And I think that's the thing that is, you know, ubiquitous. It's the same as like every kid knows who Frankenstein is. Every kid knows who Dracula is. Every kid knows who Mickey Mouse is. Kids know who Freddy Krueger is. You know, these complete like cultural symbols that cross cultural boundaries. And Godzilla's right there at the top of that list. You can't go anywhere in the world without showing like that silhouette of Godzilla. And like if you were in Helsinki, I'm sure they go, that's Godzilla. You know, if you were in Thailand, I'm sure they go, that's Godzilla. And that's pretty cool. I mean, that's a pretty intense cultural impact.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Maybe I'll go on a tangent a little bit here as well. But I looking at the modern franchises coming out of Hollywood, I'm talking about the big action movies that are non-Marvel. You know, you've got Transformers, which feels is utterly dependent on and feeding into that cultural influence. And even something like Fast and Furious, I think they're sort of like utterly joyfully unrealistic nonsense. You know, let's just fly across, you know, cars can just, it's basically a script written by 11-year-old me with my cars. Yes. And, oh, now this car can fly off the banister of the stairs and, you know, go to the moon or whatever, you know. That all feels to me very much in that similar sort of vein of high, even if it not necessarily consciously, but of like over the top escapism.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's all of the same general piece. I love it. It's, you know, like I love the Fast and Furious, you know, reference there. It's like you don't need things to be realistic to enjoy them. You know, you don't, I mean, some people do. And for some people, like, you know, those movies just don't do it for them because that's not what they're looking for out of a movie, and fine, that's totally fine. But yeah, for me, when a movie just really decides to go for it and doesn't care about any of the sort of normal, like, tropes that you would, not tropes isn't the right word, but any of the, you know, kind of normal, more serious, more realistic avenues, I love it. I don't always need, you know, a kitchen sink drama. I don't I love Jason Takes Manhattan just as much as I love Hereditary. You know, they're two different, just totally different experiences, and I love them for different reasons. Would I ever turn on Hereditary at like 3 p.m. on a Sunday? No, probably not. Would I turn on Jason Takes Manhattan? Yeah, any day of the week. You know?
Anytime.
Anytime.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, you know, works of art sort of just posit their own universe, don't they? And so it's kind of the ones that go in the middle, which sometimes are the ones that perhaps take the flack from both sides. I always think Christopher Nolan's Batman gets weird criticisms. It's just like, I remember when Dark Knight Rises came out, by which time he'd established himself as, okay, this is a universe, this is a world. And I'm a huge fan of them. I love them all. And I was just baffled by people criticizing them because of like, oh, but the length of time it would have taken for him to drop the nuclear bomb and then return. And it's just like, it's Batman. Didn't you see the bit where he was wearing a bat costume?
Yeah, around? it feels like such an unfun way to me to watch a movie,
right?
You know, or like the people with The Last Jedi that complained, well, why would they drop, how could they drop bombs down in space? You know, that doesn't make sense. Or why, you know, why would she do the light year thing to smash the ship into the other ship? Why wouldn't they do that all the time? And it's like, oh my God, everybody calm down. Just like, it's about space wizards. Like, enjoy it. You know,
exactly.
It was a cool moment. It moved the plot forward. Like, you know, it was emotional. Like, we don't need to explain everything away. And I think that that's really I don't know. Like I said, I just think that's an unfun way to watch a movie. So that always, to me, I just steer away from that.
I utterly agree. I remember there being an argument about one of the Fast and Furious films, which I enjoy. I mean, I'm not a massive fan, a huge fan or anything like that, but I've watched several and I've enjoyed them. And there was one where there's a huge runway, that there's a chase scene and it's all taking place on a runway. And I think there was even an article in the newspaper about how long is this runway? And it's just like, but surely the film itself knows that. It's not like they've sat and watched it in the editing suite and gone, you know what? I think we might be running out of runway. They've gone, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Just keep going. And as I say, if it was just a little bit too long, then that might be a problem. But the fact that it's like three times as long as the runway could possibly be, that means it's fine. You know?
Yeah, it's like when you see these YouTube videos of like 30 plot holes in Fast and Furious 7. And it's like, these aren't plot holes. These are, you know, it's not like they were like, oops, didn't, you know, forgot to include that. It's like, no, it's like, they don't care. We're not supposed to care about that stuff.
Exactly.
It's silly. People are silly.
Yeah. I think, I mean, consistency. I mean, Thelma Schumacher said it when she was editing Goodfellas. You know, she said some takes are the best takes for the performance and everything, but there'll be a continuity error. There'll be like, he's got the cigarette in the wrong hand, or the coffee cup is in the wrong position, but it's the best take in terms of the performance. And you just go, ah, fuck it. You know, people are watching for the performance. They're not. If they're watching the coffee cup, we're screwed. You know,
100%, 100%. That's definitely a thing. I mean, I was really concerned about that when I was directing my first movie, Sequence Break. You know, we'd have some moments that would be exactly that. He'd turn the doorknob with the wrong hand, or the water in the glass was of a different level. But pretty quickly, you just start going, yeah, but people are invested in the emotion and in the moment. You know, that famous scene in Star Wars where, you know, the stormtrooper hits his head on the door. It's like a lesser filmmaker, you know, would have said, oh, we've got to find a take where he doesn't hit his head, as opposed to going, no, this is when they're the most urgent. This is the better take, you know, so we don't, you know, whatever, who cares about that guy? Yeah. I think you're 100% right.
Brilliant. I love being 100% right. Listen, Graham, actually, just before I give you the last question, how has Godzilla informed your own filmmaking? Because you're an actor, you're a director. What's the connection there?
Wow, good question. I think the two main things I would say is that, especially when you look at the original film, what it's shown me is that you can have, you can make very profound and important statements through fantasy art. That you can have something, you know, that ostensibly is about, you know, a giant monster rising from the sea and attacking the city, that is also making an important statement about cultural history. At the same time, it also shows me the importance of having fun in a movie. And that, you know, when I think about what are the movies I like to go back to over and over again, they're fun. You know, I want to have fun, and they can be serious fun. You know, the original Gojira it's a serious movie, but it's fun. You know, there is that element of, you know, that nebulous term fun. What does that mean? You know, but it's still entertaining while also being something serious. And so at the same time that I look at, you know, later Showa era stuff that's just totally bonkers and ridiculous, and I go, this is also totally valid. You know, so like in the scripts that I write and in the stuff that I try to do, you know, it varies between being, you know, very intense and serious to being just like totally silly and wild. And I love that and everything in between. And so I think just the Godzilla franchise shows me the importance of having fun with your filmmaking and also not being afraid to make real statements with your fantasy art.
Amazing. And the final question that I ask everyone is to recommend a film book, a book that you've read yourself for our listeners.
Yeah, interesting. A film book. Well, obviously, I recommend my own book, Godzilla, The Official Guide to the Kingdom of Monsters.
Not allowed. That's the whole podcast is a recommendation of your book.
I know. I really love, let's see, I love If Chins Could Kill, Confessions of a B-Movie Actor, Bruce Campbell's book. That was a really big inspiration for me. I love that book a lot. There's also another book that is written by Gunnar Hansen about the making of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And it is called, I'm trying to get my brain to
Texas
remember.
Texas Chainsaw Confidential.
There it is. Thank you very much. Yes. That book, fabulous. Mm-hmm. Really fabulous. And then the last one that I'll recommend that is a real personal favorite of mine is called The Dark Fantastic. And it's a biography of Clive Barker. Really wonderful book. Clive Barker is maybe the biggest influence on me artistically, just in general. I'm a huge Clive Barker fan. And this book, The Dark Fantastic, is a really special book. And even if you're not necessarily a Barker fan or you don't know his work, it's a great book about artistic expression and about the artistic experience. So highly recommended.
Wow, those are some great recommendations. The Gunnar Hansen one I finished like a few weeks ago.
Really? Oh yeah. It's great, isn't it?
It's so good. And I was in Texas in June last year, and I went to all of the different
you went to them. That's
the
great.
Locations, you know, and it was really a lot of fun.
Did you eat at the restaurant?
No, I went in and had a drink at the original house that sort of they've moved. Yeah, I went and had a drink and took the photograph. It's still kind of creepy. It still creeps you out a little bit.
It's a little weird. I went there. It was during Fantastic Fest a number of years ago, and me and my friend Matt Mercer went out there, and it was fun. We walked in, and we could see it was the house from the outside, but we walked in, and there was like nothing there about Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which is very weird to us. It's just a bunch of like old people eating lunch. And we asked the lady at the front, like sort of desk or whatever, is this the Texas Chainsaw house? And she was like, she rolled her eyes and said, all right, let me go get Tina for you or something. She comes back with this like 18-year-old like goth girl that works there that clearly is the one person that knows everything about it. She's like, okay, let me show you. Come on. This is where Leatherface steps out. Let's go. This is where she jumps out the window. This is where Grandpa was. And then of course we had to sit in the dining room, which is the dining room from the movie. And we had some barbecue, and it was great. It was great.
Well now they've definitely there's a lot of memorabilia.
Have they done it up more?
Yeah.
That's good.
It's a proper place, and they've got models and stuff. And I mean, it's still a working restaurant and a bar, and the people sitting there were just locals having a drink. And I'm there, and they were like, do you want to take a photograph? It's like, yes, I'm there on my own. So it's like,
well, I'm sure they can see us coming from a mile away. You know, we're all wearing like a black horror t-shirt, you know.
Yeah.
It's like one of those. Okay.
Exactly. And Clive Barker, of course, I went to Liverpool, was my college town. So, I know Clive Barker from his interesting career because, you know, there was that period where he did that film. What was it then? Nightcrawlers, was it?
Nightbreed. Yeah.
And it seemed like I had the feeling when I watched that, here we go, he's going to go off into the stratosphere. And it didn't quite do that. And yet, he wrote amazing books.
Yeah, I think that he got burnt out. I mean, and you read about it in the book, but I think he got burnt out by Nightbreed. I think that the experience of dealing with the studio on that was not a fun one for him. But, I mean, yeah, his books are just phenomenal. I finally read Imagica, which is his, like, sort of biggest, it's definitely his biggest book. It's like his magnus opus. Yeah. And I just absolutely loved it. I finally, you know, it was one summer and I said, okay, I'm finally going to read this. I'm going to read this book. Cause I try, you know, it's like this thick, you know, it's gigantic, over 1,000 pages and, very rewarding, very, very much well worth it. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, listen, Graham, thanks so much for talking to me and congratulations on the book. It's an absolute, Godzilla of a book and beautiful to look at. So loads of great photographs and pictures.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Yeah, I'm really so lucky to get approached by Toho to do it. And working with them was just fabulous, and couldn't have asked really for a better dream job. I'm very, very, very thankful.
So that was Graham and I talking. We had a wonderful conversation, a wonderful time talking to him. I certainly, as you can tell from the conversation, learned a lot. It certainly broadened my attitude towards the films. I'm going to definitely root out some of those titles that Graham suggested and give them a watch. And having read the book, of course, you know, armed with the knowledge behind the monster, the man in the suit, etc. All that's left for me to do is to thank Elliot Atkins for the music. And also, next week we will have a new guest. He is going to be Stuart Clowens, and he has written a book, Crooked But Never Common, The Films of Preston Sturges. What an amazing topic, and it is a really good book. I've already read it and recorded the episode, so I can tell you it's going to be a really fun episode. I hope you enjoy it. But until then, take care.
On a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.